All this is gold.
I think we might have missed it.
Yeah. So, well, you could just say it again, and then when you inevitably say OpenAPI by mistake, we can reenact it.
What I'm trying to do is integrate OpenAI with the OpenAPI AI.
No, it's gone wrong again.
It's gone wrong again. There's been a pigeon following me all day.
You really like pigeons.
I do like pigeons, but when I was at home, there was a pigeon sat on the chimney, cooing. When I get here, there's also a pigeon sat just outside.
Do you think they're watching us?
Yes.
I have to say, though, that this is a popular haunt of pigeons, and the sound of pigeons in this room is not uncommon.
Right.
But hopefully they're quiet enough that we won't have to be editing them out. We won't have to identify the frequency of pigeon calls and put in a notch filter.
Maybe that's what we should put in AI-generated voices. A pigeon call.
Yes, that can be like the watermark.
Yeah.
And then Donald Trump will always carry a pet pigeon everywhere with him so he can deny that he said whatever it is.
Maybe that's if... Or maybe we could flip it around. So you know it's real if there's a pigeon. Because everyone has to carry a pigeon.
Yeah, because you can arrange for a pigeon to be there when it's real. But you can't arrange for one not to be there.
That would be an amazing world. Everyone had to have a pigeon with them on their shoulder.
Just to validate all of their,
just to make
all
sure
of their statements.
It's not an AI-generated voice. I see no problems with that approach.
No, I think that's the most scalable startup idea I've ever heard.
To be fair, I've worked for worse startups.
Worse than the carrying a pigeon everywhere. Startup. And what do you do with all the pigeon droppings?
You just keep them. You just go to the dry cleaners a lot.
Yeah, I guess you would.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mind you, pirates did all right with parrots, didn't they?
See? It's got historical precedent, this idea.
Yes, although I have discovered that the only reason we think pirates have a Dorset accent is because of the actor that played Long John Silver in the 1953 adaptation of Treasure Island.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it?
So all of this "Arr, me hearties" comes from this one chap infusing his background into his part.
Yeah.
So, you know, every day's a school day around
every
here,
day
isn't
is
it?
A school day. So maybe we could go back to the golden age of piracy, just with pigeons and Dorset accents.
Yes. Arr.
Oh.
Me hearties.
Me hearties.
I'm not so sure about Yorkshire
so
pirate.
Where, a place that I used to work, one of the test managers used to build like these spreadsheets, like tools to like estimate and generate test cases.
This is going to be a journey back to the point.
Yeah. And automate as well, because it was in a very strange technology stack. But he always used to put like a big... So if the tool was called Test Automator, he would put a big R on the end. And if it was... And the tool to generate test cases was called TestMate with a big E on the end. So it was Test Automator and TestMatey.
Oh my goodness.
You know, I was happy to work there just for that. Just for the level of joy that brought me when I first saw it. I was like, this is the best job I've ever had. It wasn't.
It wasn't.
But that
blinded you to it.
Yeah.
You stayed there much longer than you should have.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would think it's time to leave, and then someone at the other end of the office would shout, "Test matey."
And
I'd be like, right, I'm here for another 6 months then.
Yeah, yes.
Can't let that go.
Were they manipulating you a bit?
Probably.
Probably.
Yeah. Although I continue to manipulate them by getting them to invent more things using the same pattern.
Oh, I see. So you were responsible for perpetuating
the
pattern.
Absolutely.
And now I'm saying perpetuating the pattern. I'm hoping that
the
pop filter provision is potentially perfect.
So I have two announcements.
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 So in the chapter markers for the last episode, there are two relating to announcements. One is forgotten announcements and the other one is remembered announcements. And that was your previous announcement. So announce away.
These are remembered announcements. I don't know the ones I've forgotten. So
I've forgotten about those.
Yeah. So I finished the 30 days of AI in testing. I did all 30 days of exercises.
And how has that affected you?
So I think my general sort of understanding of generative AI, prompt engineering, the different tools that are out there, things like hallucination and various other concepts have come along quite a long way. Before I was kind of talking about them in the very general sense, but now I think got a few more specifics.
Yeah, yeah.
In total, I wrote 15,000 words on the subject in the 30 days.
Oh, wow. So are you going to publish them?
So they're published on my blog, which I'm sure we can pop a link into the show notes.
What? A link to your blog?
My blog.
Your personal blog of personalness?
Well, it's my company blog.
Oh, fair enough.
So,
of company.
Which is mainly me. But so, you know, the circle is complete. Yeah. So it was, when I looked at it in the round afterwards, I was like, I've learned a pretty amazing amount.
That's a lot of words.
Mm. It reminded me of the, was it the NaNoWriMo? Where you write a...
Oh, yes, yes.
You try and write a book in a month. 50,000
word book in a month.
Yeah. So I didn't get close to 50, but I was still pretty pleased with 15.
Yeah. That's a hefty output. What will people gain by going and reading your blog? What will they come away with?
Well, hopefully. My sort of overriding feeling afterwards was, rather than using AI to try and squeeze more efficiency out of what we currently do in the testing world, we could use it to do something slightly different and maybe show what really great testing looks like. But and using AI to do the things that it's good at, the more structured work, like helping us to automate as we explore, and sort of tying those together rather than saying, well, we're just going to use AI to generate all of our test ideas.
Yeah. Replace all of our testers.
Yeah, yeah. So hopefully, it left me feeling quite hopeful that there might be other ways to do this rather than just saying, well, just generate me a set of tests that I don't understand and then say that it's tested when we all know it's not. And then following on from speaking about TikTok last time, and that LinkedIn is my only social media remaining out of all the social media giants that are out there.
In fact, I did write something in the show notes last time about we would include our social media links, or in Ash's case, link. Are you going to tell me that I'm already wrong?
Well, so LinkedIn has announced that it's going to start doing shorts. YouTube shorts.
Oh, like
reels.
Like YouTube.
Vines.
Like, sorry, I thought you meant like American underpants.
American underpants.
Complete pivot.
I feel slightly torn now, because you know, the thing that I'm trying to escape from is chasing me onto all platforms, the short form video, which I fear so much, and even on LinkedIn. But I feel like LinkedIn will have the worst of them all.
Yeah, people's motivations for posting things on LinkedIn sometimes don't lead to what you really want to spend your time consuming.
Yeah. So I was reading something the other day about LinkedIn. Apparently there's like a pattern emerging that people will post very controversial things about, say, software development. But then if you reply refuting that, they then give you a very nuanced answer and say, well, it depends, doesn't it, on the context. And to make you look unreasonable, it's a very bizarre... I'm not quite sure what you get out of it.
Well, I was going to say, I've made 14 people look unreasonable this week. Yeah. It's a triumph.
Yeah, unless that's what you've got some kind of bonus tied to making people look unreasonable. But I was just like, what a very strange pattern to emerge.
It does sound quite odd. Although maybe it might, we'll all be answering posts on LinkedIn in an attempt to appear reasonable so reasonable that whatever the reply is, it can't possibly seem to be unreasonable.
Just, the replies just become meaningless because they're all so reasonable.
Yes. Yeah. We're just going to... What's the blandest possible replies I can make to this post?
Well, you know, nothing means anything and it all depends on context. And there's so many contexts out there that, you know, you can't pick one thing for anything to mean, can you?
I think you've just proposed a post that could be made in reply to anything on LinkedIn, on the whole of LinkedIn.
Maybe I'll just reply to everything on LinkedIn with that.
Yeah. I wonder if LinkedIn has APIs and you won't even have to do it yourself.
Perhaps I can use an AI to call the API.
Go on. It's a trap.
It's a trap. It's always a trap. So yes. I'm not going to say it.
No, no.
So they were my two announcements.
Well, so your second announcement, to summarise, is you're considering getting rid of your last remaining social
yeah, pretty
media
much thing. Pretty much.
And after I found you a Mastodon server that would be perfect, and it even has famous testing people on it.
Famous testing people.
It's very nerdy. You should give it another look.
There's a very gentle peer pressure about signing up for Mastodon.
Yes, yes, very gentle.
I'm just not ready yet. Let's think about some things.
Steady on. You're going to rush into things after only 10 minutes of wittering. Honestly, Ash.
Feel sufficiently warmed up.
Yes, I might have to do a special edit to make that true. It was only 10 minutes of wittering. let's talk about things, given that that is our ostensible reason for being here. So I have a thing, Ash.
Excellent, let's hear it.
So my thing is entitled, I'm not very good at coming up with narrowly scoped things, so this is, again, quite a broad area, but managing IT service providers.
Mm.
And this kind of comes from having been on both sides of the kind of fence. So I worked for a very large IT service provider organization for a very long time. And then more recently, in my role that I play with some companies as the, what the cool kids call a fractional CTO. But what that really means is part-time. But fractional, apparently. Sounds more cool, so that's what we now say.
I've seen that rather a lot as well, yeah, the fractional thing. I'm going to be fractional, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the other one is, it's very close to being fictional.
Fictional.
I quite like the idea of a fictional CTO.
That sounds good. I've met like a few
Gandalf.
Of those.
Sorry?
I've met a few of those.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
Science fictional yes, CTOs. Yes.
But... in that role, often the things I'm doing is trying to help companies without sort of much technical capability manage agencies or other people who they're giving quite a lot of money to to do development. And I've seen that work really well. I've also seen it go quite wrong. So I just thought it might be an interesting for us to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I've probably seen it slightly differently. As in being on the within like the development team, if you like, and seen lots of different sort of scenarios with like different providers where you've got either a single consultancy providing a team to build a thing, or multiple consultancies on the same team to try and build a thing.
Oh, that sounds that's not pretty.
And then like mixes of permanent people. Well, we're all permanent people.
Which we were.
Yeah.
We're all temporary people.
Temporary
basically.
People.
Ultimately, existentially.
So, a mix of people who work for the host organisation. and then people from consultancies and contractors and things like that. So, I've worked for both consultancies and been an independent contractor coming in off my own volition and through other consultancies as well. So I've seen a few patterns, I think.
Yeah, I think so we should be able to find something to say about this, I'm guessing, from the 12 paragraphs you immediately put in the show notes as soon as the topic was put there. I mean, my experience from the other side has generally been as part of large teams fielded by a big company.
Yeah.
And generally, if there are other people involved, it's quite often you might have the odd independent contractor filling a gap that the big company can't source. Or you have big companies that own different things. So I remember in one scenario, my company was delivering software, and then but they were delivering it to another company's infrastructure.
Oh.
Which was quite interesting. Yeah. And it ended up that the... And of course, infrastructure delivery is always interesting. It's been a bit reformed now by the cloud.
Yeah.
But it used to be, you used to see people printing money doing infrastructure because they would sign a 10-year deal, and in the last 3 years of the deal, it would be just printing money because they were charging 10 years ago prices per gigabyte for data storage and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Which they were entitled to do because of the contracts that, you know, were front-loaded with work, so they would lose money in the beginning. But, yeah, it could get... That kind of thing can get messy. But I'm quite interested in what you're saying about these kind of mixed teams, because any consultancy is kind of doing the work but also trying to sell more work at the same time.
Yeah.
And if there's someone else doing the same thing at cross purposes in the same team, that must be interesting.
Yeah. The whole selling of further work, it never really sat all that well with me when I was in a consultancy.
Mm.
I'd rather just do the work well, and then that would generate further opportunities. I was never really, you know, in that sense of a... No, I never really saw it as sales. It's just excel at what you do and deliver well, and then hopefully more work will come. But other consultancies don't subscribe to that philosophy, do they?
Well,
they say, well, I need to... There was one particular place where I was at where another consultancy's sort of salesperson stuck very close to the head of development for the host organization.
Yes.
They were... In every meeting that they were in, they were always sat next to them.
Yeah, and that's
not... You need 10 people for this. You need another tester. You need this. You need that. So that's like the flip side to just getting on with the work and delivering it.
Yeah. It's like nuclear deterrence, isn't it? If one side has one, the other side needs to have one as well.
Yeah, yeah. So I always found it... Like I say, I always found it really uncomfortable. I went down to a... their main trade was in... book publishing, which they were great at, but they were absolutely terrible at software. And they had lots of consultancies in there. And then those consultancies were not doing a very good job of testing their own work. So they brought the testing consultancy that I was working for at the time in to help.
Hmm.
And so I kind of sat there and thought, well, I know what the testing consultancy I was working for wanted me to do. They wanted me to say, you need lots of testers from our consultancy, and they need to go onto all these teams, or better still, a separate team somewhere else with lots of people on it, writing lots of test automation and doing performance testing, loads of things you don't need in order to, you know, to get the work. But to my mind, that was already what was happening with the other consultancies. They were already behaving like that, just, you know, focused on the particular products that they were developing. So I was like, I don't understand how having another consultancy will solve your too many consultancies problem. And they were like, I didn't expect you to say that. It's like, no, you probably didn't. But I'm just not sure.
I work for some people who won't expect me to say it either.
Pretty much. But these other consultancies had already agreed to do all this work.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, can't you just like ask them to do what they said they were going to do? I wasn't the person for that job. I don't think.
It's the whole thing, though, of competition between sort of and marketplaces and all this kind of stuff, where competition is not inherently a bad thing, but it needs a lot of regulation to avoid being... People can't see a system without gaming it, can they?
Yeah, but it wraps around to what... Even if it's in a big organisation, it's like what you were saying about being as a freelancer going into smaller places to help them deal with agencies. It's kind of like the same problem. It's because the host organization doesn't know what to do. So they bring someone in to help them find out what to do. But especially if you come from a bigger consultancy, you don't have the same aims as... It's not necessarily only about helping the organisation who's brought you in to deliver what they need to deliver, because you need to make some money as well. So I don't know, maybe there's freedom from that if you're an individual freelancer like yourself, because you can literally just come in and do and recommend something that's a bit more tailored to what they need. And if you get like a few months worth of work out of it, you'd be delighted.
Well, yeah. One interesting thing is this idea of the two extremes of this are the throwing it over the wall and waiting and then something comes back approach. And then there's
I'm not familiar with that approach as a tester.
And no, of course not. You would never have seen that. I'm sure other parts of the life cycle are much more much more likely to have seen that. And then the other end of the scale is the team is completely integrated and you know, you're on Slack together or you can see the team's processes and participate in them. I think that, and actually I personally much prefer that second way of doing it.
Yeah.
Because it's reducing the length of feedback loops. It's making everything, improving the clarity between, the shared clarity between everyone. But you still see the first one sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the contracts I was on, we went to this organisation and they made us wear like different coloured lanyards. and then another place wouldn't give us passes, so you had to ask to go to the toilet.
Oh.
Yeah. And it's like, what, this like
this strange, is how much we trust you.
Yeah, this sort of strange hostility towards any sort of separate entity that they had invited in, but I guess not everybody had invited us in. So that kind of thing doesn't make you feel like, it doesn't like leave you with warm feelings towards those organisations. Whereas other places, one certain particular place that I worked in Leeds, you were part of the team, you know, no particular restrictions on access. You were sort of valued.
Mm.
They didn't have like sort of divisions by, you know, some of the testers would be consultants and some would be permanent members of staff. And it was just like, it was nice. Everyone, you felt like a big team and stayed there for quite a long time and always remember it fondly. So having that sort of integrated nature really, really helps.
And would you say, I think I already know the answer to this, but would you say it helps the results or the outcomes be better?
Yes, I think so. I think so. I think if it's hard to ask consultants and contractors to buy in to what an organisation might be doing because of that slight conflict of interest that we talked about in terms of getting more sales,
yeah,
getting a contract extension, whatever it is that you're after. Mm. So, but to get them to truly buy into like what you're trying to deliver,
yeah,
is quite difficult. So bringing them in a bit more, I think that really, really helps because when you ask them to make the leap, you know, to deliver the thing that you really, really want or hit the goal that the organization's after, they already feel more affinity with the organization.
Yeah.
So it's easier to do.
No, I think that, no, I mean, I think actually people work better when they're happy.
Yeah.
And so not having to deal with the stress. I mean, imagine, I mean, that story working somewhere where they wouldn't give you a pass. And you just think, you're paying me however many £100 a day or whatever to be here. And yet you think it's okay for me to waste time.
Yeah.
Trying to, that lack of that level of trust. I mean, you could almost argue if you can't trust your supplier that much, then you should get a supplier that you can trust.
Yeah. That was very much, why am I here? In that particular example, I didn't really do anything either because I couldn't access anything. And people were quite relatively hostile. So I was just like, I remember a few days into it, I spoke to my then line manager. I was like, I don't want to do this. I'm not really doing anything. I'm just turning up in an office and not being welcome and just sitting there all day and then being sort of fobbed off, you know, when I go to speak to someone. And it's just like, what a waste of time.
Yeah. So yeah, it is. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Hmm. So one final thing that I was quite interested in with this is kind of this idea of functional consultancies. In other words, they only do one thing. So we've talked a bit about testing consultancies.
Yeah.
Does that still make sense?
I think they're going out of fashion a bit more. I think more like consultancies are offering development teams with the whole sort of suite of skills that you need in order to deliver. I think it's quite rare that you get actual specialist consultancies. Maybe the specialisms have drilled down a little bit. So you might get security pen testing specialists. Yeah. I don't think that sort of consultancy sort of sits in its own niche, if you like. But I think now, I think some sort of clients have been more interested in hiring a team to build something. From my time at Equal Experts, so they do that. That is their model. So right. You get a cross-functional team in, which has a team lead, some testers, some developers,
yeah,
data people, user research people, whatever it is that you know they've decided that that they need, and then you build the thing. And it's a nice way to do it because you kind of miss out all that strange multi-consultancy games that get played on development teams sometimes. And it's a nice, you've got like a remit and a team that are well understood and you can just sort of get on and deliver the thing. And that always seems quite nice. So to have a separate sort of functional, you know, the testers are from here and the developers are from here and the analysts are from somewhere else, it makes less sense, I think.
Do you think it would still make sense in sort of giant programs? So, I mean, I'm working in very small companies now. So I'm not really seeing this kind of project. But, I mean, I know, you know, people who are using Safe, for example, to run very big kind of delivery programs. Is that where that fits in now?
Big delivery programs. I mean, there's a problem with those anyway, isn't there, in their bigness?
Well, I think they fail a disproportionate amount of the time.
Yeah.
By some measure. I mean, fail is a fairly harsh word, but... You know, failing might mean overrunning or,
sort of or don't going hit over their budget goals or their
yeah.
first anticipated goals or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I don't know. I try and avoid those scenarios, to be honest, in terms of being sort of caught up in a very large program of work. I don't know. It just doesn't sound like a very healthy place. And I think it probably pushes, especially in terms of service providers, some really bad behaviors. Because all the, you know, the more people you add to a project just makes it later and later. All those things start to happen and it all starts to balloon out of control. And before you know it, you've got, you know, 300 or 400 people on a program of work.
Yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of video games. Video games public. video games development houses, they actively celebrate pulling everyone onto a game. And then literally like a few months later, they're like, the game is going to be delayed. And it's like, oh, really?
Are we back to magic time again now?
Yeah, pretty much. And it's like, what an amazing revelation you've just come out with. So I don't know. I think bigness comes with its own problems, doesn't it? And then if you then engage service providers to deal with the bigness of the thing that you want, then it just gets bigger and bigger and just gets completely out of control.
Bloated monster of a program.
Yeah, I think so. Because it's like the concept of flexing for demand, isn't it? It's like, well, you know, let's have such a consultancy on the side. And then if we decide we want to do, you know, twice as much things this year, we'll just flex with that. And I'm always a bit like, well, in a similar vein to the bigness thing. It's like, well, is the problem that the pipe is only so wide and you can't prioritise correctly, so you just try and like make the pipe bigger? But in a false way.
Well, just by keeping it the same size but increasing the pressure.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Well, the analogy just keeps giving and giving.
Yeah. So I'm a bit like, whenever I hear that, it's like, well, we've got this consultancy and they, you know, we flex based on need. Because in my experience, most of the time, it's just like, you just end up with them there all the time. So I'm just like, how do you, obviously the pipe is not what you need at the moment, but you don't know how to make it better, and you don't know how to prioritize what you're doing, which, let's face it, that's what it always comes back to, isn't
it?
Oh,
yeah, it does, yeah.
So I think it's that is also like a bit of a red flag for me when it comes to service providers, when just used for flexibility. Because it's like you're using it to cover a failing in the way that you build your product, or the way that you decide what to work on. And it's just costing you loads of money. So I'm a bit like, it's not the greatest.
I haven't got much to add to that, really. I completely agree with it. Okay, I just one more thing that's on my mind about this, and that is, when do you decide that enough is enough and fire your service provider?
Yeah.
Because sometimes you see it just kind of gets worse and worse until the relationship breaks down irretrievably and everyone's reading contracts instead of talking to each other.
Yeah.
But it'd be nice to sort of be able to realise, oh, okay, well, let's move on before you kind of got to that sort of stage. But at some point, you've got to figure out if it's not working.
Yeah, yeah. So while I was at the test people, a somewhat rogue element of the test people, let's say.
A rogue element.
This would be a
thing.
Are we
going to have to edit the words of the test people out of every sentence that you
mentioned? Well, the test people don't exist anymore.
Okay.
So we don't need to edit it out.
They can't sue us.
Yeah. So a certain element tried to engage with a customer in slightly different ways. So they said, we'll have a 6-month contract, but it will have a rolling 2-week get out for both sides.
Oh.
So what will happen is we'll demonstrate the work that's been done every 2 weeks. And then the customer can either say, that's enough, we're happy now, or carry on. Or the consultancy could say, we want out, because we'd had a few jobs in the past where it was like, you just need to write some tests for this. And that turns into
just.
Yeah, exactly. And then that turns into days and days and weeks of virtually everybody in the company trying to test this thing that was just a couple of days' work.
Oh.
So, but the consultancy didn't want that, because you can't budget with that, can you?
No.
If someone says after 2 weeks, it's like, from a technologist point of view, the client could have said after 2 weeks, that's perfect, that's all we need. And that would have been a great 2 weeks worth of consultancy. But you can't put that in your forward plan for the next year, can you? As a definite thing that you're going to get.
So this rogue element.
it's quite intriguing, isn't it?
Yes, without inquiring too deeply about any particular people that may have comprised the rogue element. How long did it go for?
It carried on for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Thing is, it was a valuable element as well.
Yeah, so that helps.
Which allowed it some roguish tendencies.
Some roguish tendencies. Yes. Yeah. I, when you say testing people with roguish tendencies, I just feel that that's leading me somewhere. I'm not quite sure where it can be. But that seems like a really good way of doing things. And of course, it sort of avoids the question of when is the testing finished, which I know you enjoy having a view about, because we had quite a reasonable amount of the last episode to that question. But yeah, so that's a really good, that seems like a really quite nice way of doing it, because it means that you're basically normalizing asking the question of, is this still valuable?
Yeah.
Every, in a relatively rapid time frame.
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes there's interesting examples where the host organization will take like the cheapest option as well. So, because you were talking about helping to do diligence for smaller clients on their digital agencies or whoever they're engaged with.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they've got a few bids. So I was in one particular place and they had a few bids. It was a third-party streaming video provider. We were asked to assess them technically. So I watched them. I asked for access to their source control and they didn't use it. and then I said, we want you to deploy your services to one of our test environments. So I got them access and said, can I sort of hang out with you while you do it? And they were just like changing things on the fly in config on this server. It's like, you know, have you not got like a pipeline for this or anything like that? And they were like, no, I just need to change this config item. Oh, it still doesn't work. Oh, maybe this one. Maybe this one. I was like, how can you remember what you've changed? How do you know what works?
And they said, if only there was some technology that could help us do this in a structured and managed way. But it just doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. They were like, yeah, I don't know. We need a miracle. But they were cheap. So they got them. So they got the gig.
And how well did it go?
Terribly. It never worked.
No.
Until, and this is also the common thing as well, we had to go and do it. So the people who worked at the organization were just like, basically, you can't do it, but you've provided the product. So, you know, we put all the config into source control and built a pipeline for it. Which I'm sure that they went, what a wonderful idea.
That's a jolly good idea.
So there's so many terrible examples like that. I don't know. I think perhaps I'm slightly damaged goods when it comes to service providers because I've just seen too much. The horror is...
horror is real.
Is too deeply embedded.
The carnage.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that in there, in all the experience, there's like a pattern. Because I think I wrote in the notes. So I said, if we could set a minimum technical competency level, which is comparable to the host organization, before heading through the door, interview any new starters that come along from the consultancy.
Yeah.
Treat them like humans and part of the team, but probably don't put them in long-term leadership and strategy positions.
Seems fair.
And then have a plan to be without them soon, whatever soon looks like for you, 6 months, a year. But not 20 years.
No.
Because that's not soon, is it?
It's hard to imagine a perspective from which that is soon.
Yeah. Yeah. So my final, in my comment on the show notes, it just says, I just haven't seen too many thoughtful approaches, to be honest. Just endless horror.
This is like Jerry Springer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Here's my final thought.
Yeah. But if you've got lots of different technology people to come and talk about this subject, I think you'd get something quite similar.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think we seem quite aligned about a lot of this.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I'm mindful that you probably got, if you got someone who works for a big consultancy, with lots of tales of horror on the other side.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Clients, the worst.
Yeah, exactly. Who needs them, eh?
Yeah. Hey ho. Anyway. That was my, as usual, very large and woolly thing. But I feel like there's some sense been made of some of it. So that's good. Thank you.
Great thing.
Thank you for making sense of my thing. So in the last episode, we had an agile interlude between the things.
Oh, yes, of course.
So I'm just wondering, you know, should I try and get out of my chair or something just for laughs?
Maybe you could try and get your pigeon. Put it on your shoulder so I know that you're not an AI.
Well, you could do that, but I feel that you're biased in this instance because no one except for you has ever given me a sticker of a pigeon.
Mm.
I mean,
with my head on it.
With your head on it. Mm. I mean, what is the story? Why is there a pigeon with your head on it?
So Gwen Diagram likes pigeons. I have a head that looks...
She likes your head as well.
Yeah. So
are two of my favourite things.
And a chap called Chris Chant said, I've got you some stickers done. And it was a pigeon with my head saying, testability, yeah.
I've got one. I still look bemusedly at it from time to time as to say that this has a story, but I've never before known what the story was.
Yeah. Well, someone saw it at an event a little while ago and then said, I like pigeons as well. And he was an actual like pigeon fancier. So he had like racing pigeons and things like that. And he showed me pictures.
So would you say Gwen was not an actual pigeon fancier?
Well, she doesn't keep pigeons. She just
observes them,
enjoys them.
Oh, well, she should come and visit this office sometimes because there's no shortage of pigeons to be had here.
No.
Oh, well, that was better than an agile diversion. A pigeon interlude. So I'm hoping that after all that, you will have a thing as well. Because we've only been going for 3/4 of an hour and we need more content.
That's true. That's true. I do have a thing.
What is your thing?
I want to talk about AI voice cloning.
Oh, AI again. Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I think as it matures, or as or it doesn't mature, or society doesn't mature, or everyone's immature, I don't know. Or we just build things without much thought about what they actually mean, and then we just unleash them.
So, oh, this is interesting. If you bang these atoms together, it makes a really big, really big bang.
Bang the rocks together, people. That's the secret.
Yes.
So I think it has the potential to be one of those where we have a very, very advanced voice cloning functionality offered, which has many, many uses, some of them good, some of them bad. The technology itself obviously is different to the intent of using it for whatever purposes that you want to use it for. Mm. So, but the thing that interested me was that OpenAI.
Very well said.
Very well said. So they've created this new capability, and it's extremely powerful. So you can take 15 seconds of someone's voice, and it will create a clone with the tone, inflection. Apparently, I'm a tester, so when people say, "Oh, this thing will do this," I'm always like, "Will it?
Will it now?
Will it now?
Will it really?"
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll tell you if it does that. Yeah.
Well, we could feed it a good few hours of what a lot of things, and then we could just publish, it could just send it away to make episodes on its own. They'd probably come out more regularly than ours.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true. We'll be stuck for hours editing.
Yes. Oh, no. don't even joke. Anyway, sorry. Yes. Serious thing.
So 15 seconds of audio from a person, and then you can create a clone of their voice, which is incredibly accurate. Or so the claim goes. So there's a few examples of this. So my favourite one was James Earl Jones allowed Disney to clone his voice to use as Darth Vader.
Thus saving him a load of inconvenient acting.
Yeah, exactly.
But presumably he did that with some sort of contract that every time he did it, he would get money.
Yeah, so he got paid.
Unlike where some other big media conglomerates are going.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess that's the worry, isn't it? So you got like the positive uses of the technology, although, you know, masquerade, an AI pretending to be Darth Vader is, well, I guess it is a positive use if you like that kind of thing.
what kind of thing is that exactly?
Like entertainment. So if you like Star Wars, it's a positive thing. Although there was another example where, for example, someone had a vascular brain tumor which made them lose their voice, but they still had recordings of them, so they put it through a voice cloning AI program and they got to speak again.
Did you know that your iPhone has that capability? You can record your voice into your iPhone and it is then able to, not all that well it must be said, say things in your voice, and you can then use it for that eventuality.
Yeah, so I didn't know that. I mean, maybe this is like the next evolution of that kind of capability.
I think there's a lot of room for that capability to improve. So I think you're probably right.
Yeah, yeah. And then, but then you're kind of on the flip side of that example of something really positive. So it's, you know, someone can they can speak to their family members again using their own voice, which, you know, I think we can probably agree is a very positive thing.
Yeah.
But then it was used to create a scam phone call using Joe Biden's voice to people.
Yes, I think we should be specific that this wasn't OpenAI's technology that was used. It was, there are quite a few companies that have variations of this kind of thing and some open source stuff as well, I think. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that usage was clearly, I mean, it was, I think they were telling Americans not to bother voting.
Yeah. Yeah. So appealing to our natural sense of apathy.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So OpenAPI with their product. Oh, I did it. So then OpenAI.
OpenAPI with their AI.
So OpenAI's approach is to release this to a limited amount of people because they're mindful of what the impact might be, especially in an election year. Which is interesting, isn't it? Because I don't think ChatGPT, as in the generative AI, was pretty much just released widely without too much sort of limitations put on it.
I can't remember back in the beginning of it whether there was a beta. I certainly wasn't involved in it.
Yeah.
But with their more recent products, I think mostly for capacity management purposes, a lot of the newer, you know, when the GPT-4 Turbo API came out, that was, you know, you had to ask to be allowed onto that, and then they expanded it out. But I think I'm not sure that they were doing any of that for the purposes of stopping people from misusing it. I think they were doing that to manage their capacity of their ability to deliver it. So I'm not sure, but maybe this is a sort of new one for them.
Yeah. So it feels like a nice change, a sort of welcome change in approach. Because they basically argued that you need to give society time to adapt. I mean, I don't know how long society takes to adapt. I'm British, so it takes about 100 years for us to adapt to anything, doesn't it? Pretty much. 20 mile an hour zone, 100 years.
Don't mention the war.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not sure that giving society time to adapt, well, I suppose it depends on the society, but because there are certain implications. So one of the examples given is that, say, if your bank still offers phone banking, then that could be very vulnerable to voice cloning, whoever offers it, not necessarily OpenAI, but whoever offers it.
I mean, potentially, although you need to know other things than just sounding like you.
Yeah, yeah. But it opens up a...
Well, it would be evidence, wouldn't it? This is your voice saying that you want to do this thing.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's an interesting thought to allow society to adapt. I don't know whether or not it'll work in practice. So I think adaptation it will be necessarily non-uniform across different bits of society.
But there is that tension, isn't there, between the freedom side of it. So it's like open source software. I mean, it's impossible to imagine what the world would be like now if we had never had open source software. And for whatever his failings might be, you know, Richard Stallman coming up with the GPL license, that's really moved the world forward and, you know, the variations of that. And then you can see that there are plenty of open source large language models like Llama 2. So Meta have been very consistent about open sourcing their stuff. And there are other open source models. But you kind of think, how do you manage the tension between allowing that freedom that really helps innovation to happen but also giving people tools with which they can do mischief? And I suppose it's the age-old question of technology, isn't it? I remember... a friend of mine, I may have mentioned this before, a chap called Alec Muffett, who's been many things, but he's a security researcher and other things like that. And he wrote in the 90s, he released an open source program called Crack, which would take Unix password files and then try its damnedest to guess all the passwords in them. And you could view that, as he did, as a tool for system administrators to improve the quality of people's passwords. Or
On the other side.
You were arming the hackers. And he was, I think he was amusingly roundly condemned in some of the more pompous newspapers in this country anyway, yeah, for it. But there genuinely is great value in that tool at that time. There was great value in it for people who, you know, were running systems, and the people who were trying to break into them already had password guessers.
Yeah.
So I wrote my first password guesser when I was, I suppose, 19 on the Sun workstation. It wasn't very hard to do.
Yeah.
People who were trying to do bad things, and I wasn't trying to do bad things, I was just interested in learning, but people trying to do bad things at that time, they already had that. Obviously, if you look at the various countries around the world who want to undermine Western democracy, they've already got...
Well, including got Western models. Democracies.
Yes, including us ourselves. We seem to be... Yeah. Good point, well made. But they've got language models. They can use the things that already exist to do voice synthesis. Or they could just get a really good impersonator, for goodness sake. I mean, you know, that's not... There have always been people who've been able to imitate other people's voices.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know where I'm going with that, except that my instinct with these things is normally to err on the side of letting people have it.
Yeah.
Because then you find out what it can do, good and bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, like I said, having an early access phase is to sort of choice. I mean, I guess it depends who you choose to have it. is you know, in terms of software in general, is a pretty decent practice, but that only gets you certain types of information. You might get some operational information, or you might give it to people that you trust to use it well, and within acceptable sort of moral parameters, if you like.
Yeah.
But then once you start to open it out a bit more, the sample of people that you're giving it to gets much, much wider, and you don't know where it's going to go.
An interesting thing there is how fast it is. So there's a kind of dream, isn't there, that you can have a real-time conversation using voice with an AI. And you can talk to ChatGPT. You know, there's on the app, on the phone apps for it, you can have a voice conversation with it, but there's a lot of waiting while it makes pretty patterns on the screen while it's thinking what to say and then generating the way to say it.
We all need to pause a bit more before we talk, don't we?
Yeah, apparently this is the key to stopping saying which I have to edit a reasonable amount of erms out of all of our episodes.
I don't know what you mean.
I haven't quite learned how to not say But I think you're right. We do. I think pausing during speech is actually a good thing to be able to do. But it's also, there you go, that was a genuine one. It's also the idea that if it's able to generate speech in real time, because if it doesn't have to be in real time, then you send it some text and then, you know, 30 seconds later it comes back. Then in that time, a language model can read it and say, and you could say to GPT-4 or something, is this... seem to be malicious. And you know, then you could say, well, I'm not doing that because I think you're being malicious. But if it's supposed to work, if it's able to work in real time, you couldn't really do that.
It would
be a different, you'd have to come up with something different if you wanted to stop people misusing that.
Because I think for this sort of generation of voice cloning, the idea is to add like a sonic signature as a watermark.
Oh, very clever.
So you can then go and detect whether or not it's an AI that's generated it. But only if the generating program obviously inserts the signature.
An open source one could be.
So from the bigger players in the space, you probably find that this signature would be inserted. Whereas but I guess it's the same with the password cracker, isn't it? It's like, well, if you are going to be nefarious with it, then your tools are probably way ahead of all the other tools out there for doing that, for doing whatever nefarious thing that you want to do. So those people would have had a password cracker for years and years and years. Which would...
And actually, I think what Alec wanted to do, and I, it's a bit dangerous to speak for him, obviously, but was to give everybody the best one.
Yeah.
So that the hackers didn't have the miscreant side of the equation didn't have a better one.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was the best one. And that's, you sometimes hear the sort of Sam Altmans of the world saying stuff like, actually, the way to manage this is to make sure that the goodies, not the comedy trio from the 70s, but the people on the side of I'm struggling to define what I mean by this now, because I think there aren't any bloody goodies, but there must be. But the goodies should always be able to have the best AI.
Yeah.
And now I'm just thinking of Graham Garden and Bill Oddie having the best AI. I shouldn't let my brain out, really. But yeah, you want the side of the people who aren't trying to destroy stuff to have the best resources, or at least equal resources. And you sort of think, I don't know, that seems like a principle that might be useful
to take
into account.
Yeah. So like you say, having like equal tooling, the equal ability to either to combat. So at least you're coming at it from a where you can sort of stand on your own two feet, if you like, in terms of rather than having like some kind of wild inequality, or at least believing that you've got the best tools. So I think that's one of the things as well, especially with security problems in systems, is that you believe, because you buy like some kind of tooling from some vendor, that they've got it covered, and they don't most of the time. So I think the belief that you have the best tools, when the people who you are in opposition with won't tell you about the tools that they have. They exist in the dark. So it's relatively naive. So I see what Mr. Moffat was doing there, and saying, well, at least
Moffat
is at least the playing field is level now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to be
an AI
hater.
Yeah.
I see the value in voice cloning as Darth Vader. And also, if you've lost your voice for whatever reason, or you've not been able to speak for a long time, then you're going to find the Darth Vader button.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
That's uncanny.
It sounded just like Darth Vader, didn't it?
So I'm trying not to be an AI hater.
I think that's good. I also don't want to be an AI hater, as was probably apparent.
Yeah.
But it is a difficult and complicated question, because open source language models sort of defeats the idea of only billionaires can have this.
Yeah, yeah.
And I kind of approve of that. It also puts it in the hands of bad people.
Yeah.
And I don't like that, but I don't, it seems like it's like free speech, isn't it? If you have free speech, then you have to accept people saying bad things.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that free speech is a bad thing.
No. But I think with voice cloning, it's like, okay, there's some very positive sides to it. And yeah, I can imagine a few applications which would be very bad. But OpenAI, with their tool at least, have said, we're going to limit the release of it in this election year, which to me is a fairly responsible thing to do. And so I think we can hopefully take that as a sign of the future for that particular organisation, that they're going to try and put responsibility first, the amazing things that they do.
Which we can certainly applaud. Yep. So what do you think OpenAPI will be doing?
Nothing.
Well, not nothing.
Nothing. at all with voice cloning.
With fair enough. Sorry, I'm going to mock you about that some more, probably.
It's okay. I will recommend that we edit it out.
Yes. And of course, I will just blindly take your recommendation.
Yeah. Well, it's easier that way as well, isn't it?
It's easier for me, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was my thing.
I love that thing. I'm very interested in the AI things at the moment, as you can probably tell. And I think that kind of brings out all of those tensions between that freedom and freedom of access and all that kind of thing with the sort of bad things that people sometimes want to do. Yeah. So I think, fantastic. Thank you.
And like you say, some incredible technologies have resulted from open source and the principles around it. Like, for example, you can get a library which will add any number of zeros to the left side of a number and you don't have to work out how to do it yourself. But I always like that one because the maintainer took it down because he got annoyed. And then everyone was like, oh my God, none of our systems work anymore.
Yes, yes.
How do you add zeros to the left-hand side of a number? I don't know.
Yes, which makes me now think about the XZ or XZ, I suppose lots of people would like me to call it, thing about the... But maybe that can be a thing next time.
Yeah,
maybe that can be a whole thing because there's an awful lot of in there.
Definitely.
In fact, I might have to Bagsy that one.
Not if I put it in first.
Dibs. Oh, how childish we are.
Mm, that's the problem,
isn't it? I always feel like when we were on Twitter, we had a good mainstay joke that we could make about our Twitter handle being "What a Lot of Thing."
You've got to change. And then we always
you don't have to change them. Sometimes it might be recommended. But now that we don't have a Twitter account or that joke anymore, despite the fact I managed to drag it out for one last outing just there. But if you want to talk to us about any of the things we talk about, we would love that. Although I'm going to say the only way you can do it is by using our LinkedIn group.
We must have an email as well.
Well, we have an email, but don't think either of us read it.
No, I don't look at that. Well, maybe we can sort out a better email solution.
Well, I'd like to. I'd like to connect the domain properly.
So yeah, maybe for next episode we can say, contact us at this email address.
We could just say it now because we could then set it up before we publish the
episode. No.
It's the temporal magic of time.
No, we don't do that because then that means that there'll be a rift in the fabric of space-time if it doesn't happen.
It's not a deadline, Ash. It's only an email address.
So I spend virtually my whole software development life because people always say, well, I'll tell you what, if we tie these two things together, then that'll be amazing, won't it? And then you're like, well, no, because then we can't release one of them, can we? And people are always like, oh, well, I've made this dependent on this. I've made this pull request, but it's branched off the other branch. I'm like, don't do that, because then they have to go together. And then someone says, why can't we release? And it's because you've made things that have to go together.
Yes.
So don't do that.
Loosely coupled components, kids.
Yeah.
It's the magical magic.
Magical magic
that keeps
time.
Keeps your system working. No, there's no magic time. Loosely coupled, highly cohesive components. That's what you need to build.
And that's what magic time is all about.
No. Magic time is about never sleeping until you die. It does get quite magic after the first few days because you start to hallucinate.
It does. I imagine it does,
Yes.
Right, let's finish there.
So...
Let's literally just finish.
The email address will be in the show notes. Please email us because we really, really want to hear from you.
Yes, we do. We don't know how to end an episode, do we?
No. We just slowly talk and talk and talk until it peters out.
Yeah.